Hello and welcome to recording number 6 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is August 5th, 2021. All right, well, we finished up yesterday where Gord was back. They were covering where Gord's been since he had left the Cat Lords after he'd been killed by the devil pig, and with his cat's cat's eye ring, he had 9 lives. He had 8 left, and he's used up another one. And he went to the domain of the Cat Lord, and there his paramour Tirup had to leave, and he was decided to leave himself. And Rexphalus was headed back to Earth, to the domain of the Demiurge in the Vale of the Archmage, which we know of as the Vale of the Mage. He's just called the Mage of the Vale there. And he is either Jason or Jaren Crimea, where Gygax has him the Demiurge Basiliv. And I have to say, I like the Basiliv much better. So, Gord, there's one town, one small town, 3,000, 4,000 people in the Vale. And there's a building there that when Basiliv is in residence, it's a small building from the outside, but a little Doctor Who TARDIS-like on the inside, where it's much bigger inside than out. Unless Basiliv is gone, and then it's just a big, small, empty building. So he has been talking with the Demiurge, and the Demiurge has been saying some things that have Gord a little confused, and we're going to start on page 66, and it is the last paragraph. What on earth this bizarre spellworker was speaking of, Gord had no idea. Genes? Perhaps they were some form of guardian genies. He didn't know. And what manner of business Gord and the Demiurge could possibly have between them was totally beyond him. Despite the awesomeness of the two figures he was with, the young man actually began to become annoyed. It seems that you have the advantage of me, as does the master of cats. He said, I am at a loss, as I already stated. I must know what is going on if I'm to do anything at all. This brought laughter from both Demiurge and Cat Lord, and their laughter was both real and friendly. Seldom does anyone manage to get the advantage of you these days, Master Gord, Aslov said after composing himself. Let us depart this too formal audience hall for my private chambers. And so saying, he got up without ceremony. His guests followed him, and soon all three were seated in a crowded but comfortable study of some sort. Gord didn't recognize much of what lay around him, but there were books, maps, and charts in profusion, along with the paraphernalia of Demer crafting. There were also strange, large seats of padded and most comfortable sort for each of them. Refreshments floated in the air, trays of beverages and tidbits of tasty food that served each of them in turn, Cat Lord, Gord, and then Basiliv. Now that's better, the Demiurge said contentedly as he leaned back in his chair and sipped the fruity concoction he had selected. Rexphalus, he went on while looking at Gord, you told me this one was unusual, but I hadn't appreciated until now just how unusual he might be. As always, dear Basiliv, I have a tendency to understate. Let us suppose it is simply a case of blood telling. With a shake of his large, black-maned head, Basiliv turned to stare at Rexphalus a moment, shook his head again, and returned his gaze to Gord. So it is information you must have, is it? I shall now do my best to supply you with just that. All right, just a break right here. I noted in the last recording that Basilev refers to Gord's having good genes. And I was wondering if that was something just that was commonly known. But obviously, it's something known only to perhaps interplanar travelers or just the very learned and wise Earth. And so Gord has no idea what he's talking about as far as genes go. So I find that it's probably a good thing that it isn't generally known and that their knowledge isn't that advanced, except for very few. Because while the setting is fantasy and you can have big incongruities as far as knowledge and technology, the setting is really a kind of semi-medieval fantasy. So it's kind of good to know that that isn't just common knowledge about genetics. All right. So the Basilev is still, they're still making implications about Gord's relation to the Cat Lord, where, the Cat Lord, Basilev is complimenting Gord, and the Cat Lord says that, blood will tell. So I think we're really looking at, we're right at the point where Basilev and maybe the Cat Lord are going to reveal some information about Gord's lineage and past. I'm also wondering, they referred to Basilev. I'm not sure whether is Rexvilus, they're saying, has a large black-maned head, or whether it is Basilev, the Demiurge, who has it. And I'm not sure here whether that might imply a relation to the Cat Lord themselves. And Chris has put up, the picture here of how this Valley of the Mage, how secluded it is. I mean, other than the barrier peaks, and, that is a very, inhospitable, very hard to cross into the barrier peaks. Then we have this little enclosed Valley of the Mage behind the dim forest to the northwest and down. And the dim forest itself is a, more of a secluded forest than, many others. So it's not a place that is very well traveled. Now, during the invasion of Geoff, it was one of the refuges, I believe, when they rode up against the giants. The dim forest was supposed to be one of the places of refuge and against the invading creatures. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 67. And it is the second, the last paragraph. Then the Demiurge related to Gord how he had kept track of events in the past, events surrounding the three portions of the evil device that would awaken the slumbering Tharizdun, lord of all evil. One who would weld demon and devil together and bend the abyss and the hells to his vile will. Basilev said that he knew of the Scarlet Brotherhood's discovery and use of the initial key, and that he had done what he could to confuse them so that the middle portion of the artifact would not also fall into their hands. Contending factions work against the forces of good, and those who seek balance as well as evil, the Demiurge noted. Too many desire to use the malign powers of the artifact for their own ends. Nothing beneficial ever comes of evil, Master Gord. Remember that. Even I, in my young and foolish past, have misused my powers and wrought badness, seeking nothing but seclusion. Now folk fear and hate me, I know. Oh, their feelings are misplaced at this time. The past gives them cause, but I digress. Aslav paused and quaffed his concoction again, and continued. My friend and associate Rexvilus has always believed as I do now. That is why he and I are united now to achieve a certain goal. He suggested that you, Gord, might be the one to bring our desires to fruition. I believe his perception is correct. After another short pause, the Demiurge explained himself further. The contending factions, which would have the final key, are so busy fighting with one another that most have effectively taken themselves out of the contest, as it were. That is as it should be. But can the lords of the upper planes use, or even hold, the key? Not likely. Its base vileness would soon bring it into the hands of those who want to awaken. That dark being who sleeps. Do the Kabbalists have better skills, the Hierophants? Never. And I am no more fit to employ such an object than is Mordenkainen, or any of the others who would have it. Despite intentions, they would find themselves growing as evil as the one whose essence is the artifact. Do you understand? I'm breaking right here. And again, the little Tolkienisms kind of show forth. The artifact is very much, we have, Ariston really does seem not so much as Thauron, but as Sauron's master.
Morgoth.
Although this artifact is very similar to the ring, and what Baslev is saying is that Mordenkainen, or Baslev, or even the good deities or the good beings, they would become corrupted by the artifact, so that it's not something for any of the people of the balance, the neutrals or the good, to wield. And the best they can hope to do with it is to hide it away somewhere out of the chance of it coming into the hands of someone who wants to either unite the artifact to release Tharizdun, such as the Scarlet Brotherhood, or else it would fall into the hands of just the evil, who might end up gaining more than one part of it and inadvertently causing the awakening of Tharizdun. It's a very risky thing for Gratzt or Zuchtmoy. While Yggdrasil holds the second artifact, it's very dangerous for her allies to be able to hold the third artifact. And as there's a desire for those artifacts to rejoin beyond just, so there are forces going to be at work to join those artifacts together, even if these evil beings think there isn't. They're going to want to unite two to get the power, and then, for some reason, the third's going to be drawn into it. Neutral and good characters might be corrupted with it. So Baslev is doing a bit of a Tolkien-like warning about possession of this artifact. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 69, paragraph 1. I hear what you say, Lord Demiurge, Gord replied slowly. I think I perceive the point you are driving at. I do not understand, however, why you are telling me that you have no desire to yourself possess the final key. Quite so. You do not yet understand because you are unaware of what has recently transpired. Let us have another round of potables, and then Rexvilus and I, my boy, will provide you with all there is to know on this matter. Several hours later, Gord saw the whole matter in a new and very different light. He had taken no oath nor sworn any vow, And he knew within himself that he must now what he must now do. After shaking hands with Basilev and bowing in farewell to the Cat Lord, Bord simply walked out of the Demiurge's strange palace and into Bar Dillingham. In less than an hour, he met up with a party of the Demiurge's soldiers, who apparently had been awaiting him, packed his possessions, which had been brought from his room in the castle, and Ott was on his way out of town. He rode northward in company with a mixed group of closed-mouthed men and taciturn elves. The latter were called Grugma, by their own kind, and Valley Elves, a term of derisive sort, by men and other sorts of elves who dwelled outside the realm of Basilev. It was not a particularly pleasant trip. The soldiers of the Demiurge show great respect and deference to Gord, but kept themselves isolated from him. The landscape was interesting at least, which made the journey somewhat more bearable. They traveled from valley to foothills to mountains, the first peaks Gord had ever seen. On this, well, I'm going to break right here. Now, just two things, really. I mean, we get a little information about the valley, but Valley of the Mage, but not too much. Now, I don't believe we have a map here of the Valley of the Mage, and probably a lot of Living Greyhawk campaign information, because there appears to be quite a number of towns and no Bar Dillingham.
I thought that was a little strange.
Well, you know, it's just because it could have come from the ashes or from, you know, another source, but it's following its own place rather than trying to follow like any of the Gygaxian stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think that all the towns were strange. I just thought it was weird that there wasn't a Bar Dillingham.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the people who took over the Valley of the Mage, it's quite possible none of them even read or even knew about these books, and especially about the new Infinities books.
Right.
A lot of them wouldn't have cared anyway, especially with the Living Greyhawk campaign, because they were given certain areas and, you know, they wanted to have adventures and do things. And if they were given, I don't know if anybody was, but if some, you know, group, area was given Valley of the Mage, it's all they had to work with. So, they might just have said, well, we need towns, we need things to do our adventures, otherwise we're kind of stuck adventuring out of our region. I really wouldn't have been pleased if I were given Valley of the Mage for my area. It's supposed to be this hyper-protected valley, and, it's not supposed to be a place in itself of great adventure. Now, one thing that I thought interesting, I believe at the end of Artifact of Evil, when Mordenkainen was bringing his forces out, I believe that some of his forces were called Valley Elves. And yet, the way I had thought was that the Valley Elves were only from this area, you know, the Valley of the Mage, even in the regular material. And here Gygax again seems to say, and he's the one, I think, who had Valley Elves as part of Mordenkainen's forces. So, no, I don't know. I don't know if they're limited to this valley or whether they were, you know, loaned out or went to serve Mordenkainen. Or, I mean, Basilev himself brings up Mordenkainen, but saying that even Mordenkainen himself would be corrupted by the power of the second artifact, which, you know, Mordenkainen was, Mordenkainen was willing to aid the evil forces of Uz to bring that second artifact within his grasp. So, you know, it's just a Mordenkainen. Mordenkainen is real in neutral in the respect that he's, I think, first out for himself, you know, but not in a particularly evil way. But I think, you know, he's considering his, you know, greater good over other people's greater goods. All right. And he seems very supremely confident in himself, Mordenkainen. All right. So now, what was the other thing here? It was the Valley Elves. And they seem to be moving in a northerly direction. Oh, that's what it was. Now, the Barrier Peaks are big mountains. But Gord actually, when he went through the center of the there was a mountain, several mountains down when he went on the quest to find the relic held by the Catabline demon. Now, I don't know. I think they might have just crossed the hilly area, but I had thought they had actually crossed the center, which had small area of actual mountains. So I don't know. It says here these are the first peaks he's ever seen, and I thought he had actually seen maybe smaller mountains, but mountains when he was down, you know, down there between what was it, Divers and Greyhawk. All right, and that was in Saga of Old City at the end.
In the Arbor Owls.
Yes. Yeah, and I think there were the very small mountains, but there were also the hills, you know, the Karn Hills there.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought they were at least small mountains in the Arbor Owls. So we get sometimes, we are now getting a few books away from there, so I don't know. So it just said, first peaks Gord had ever seen, and I didn't think that was true. All right, it's page 69, and the last paragraph. On the second day after leaving the town, once the group was well into the Bering range, the elves and men turned back, taking with them the horse that Gord had ridden. It would not go farther than the boundaries of their lord's domain. New escorts took over, though, so Gord did not have to worry about being abandoned in the vastness of rock that jutted and towered so majestically. The 50 soldiers of the Demiurge's troop were replaced by 4 times that number of dour dwarves dressed in iron and steel armor. The long-bearded mountain dwarves dealt summarily with any predatory creatures foolish enough to approach them. Gord and this small army of dwarves trudged upward into the mountains, going ever higher. Soon Gord recalled, the very air seemed so cold and thin that he felt like he was being strangled. Broad-chested dwarves appeared not to mind the rare atmosphere, but they deferred to the young human, taking a path through the mountains that was not the shortest, but which enabled the group to avoid climbing to even higher elevations. Gord was glad when their path led downward, and some of the deep breaths he took were genuine sighs of relief. He was surprised that the dwarven company remained with them, and they all finally left the mountains 4 days after beginning their descent toward less rugged ground. They had come to the rough foothills on the north side of the Bering Mountains, an area called the Pen Wilds, where few folk lived and game abounded. Gord hunted with success and greatly enjoyed the wild lonesomeness of the place. Noting this, the dwarves warmed to him a little. "You, Gord of Greyhawk, roam thus in your own lands," the captain of the band asked him one night as they camped. Gord replied in the negative. but then told the broad dwarf of his adventures in other places, his hunts, his combats with monsters. "I see why you are a chosen one," the fellow rumbled when Gord had finished. "Our gift to you is this," he said, and held forth a broad amulet of varicolored gold. It was a work of odd design, its material being gold of hues like palest sunlight, deepest sunset orange, gold green, and violet gold intermixed with the usual yellow gleam of the ore. "I cannot accept such a treasure," Gord said. "No, man, you cannot refuse it," the dour demihuman rebutted. "We all depend on you, and this is our offering of success." Gord took the band, amped it around his bicep, and nothing more was said on the subject. The next day, they came to a place where the hills became more gentle, and trees dotted valleys and hilltops alike. In the distance, the mass of a forest could be seen, blanketing the last low ridges and mounds of the Penn Wilds. Here, the company of dwarves told Gord that they would go no further. "You are now at the edge of the briar-tangle woodland," Gord, the gnarled captain of the demi-human band, said to him. "That little brook there is the headwater of the river Baklunish humans call the Tuzmik. If you keep it on your left hand, it will guide you through the forest till Lupalu." All right, break. Now, we're right into the section where Gygax had to change some names. Lupalu is Lapala in Ket. Briar Tangle is what? The Bramblewood? And I'm not quite sure what the Penn Wilds are offhand.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah. It is a little bit confusing. We are going to have to, since we're dealing with all the new Infinities books from this point on, I'm really going to have to work up a little Gygax New Infinities to TSR translation of names. I'm sure there's actually something, I've seen something like that out there, and I just have to track it down. So Gord has now been given some kind of gold artifact, and I like the addition of the mountain dwarves. Back when I was doing G-series, there was actually Lost Kingdom of Dwarves, up in the mountains on their way to going to the Jotuns and the, the Frost Giants, domain there. All right. I am going to restart, and it is page 71, and the fifth paragraph from the top. Such a speech was quite a bit for a dwarf to say, and this impressed Gord. "Many thanks, good captain. May I ask a question?" And the dour fellow nodded assent. The young adventurer went on with, "Why do you name me as a chosen one?" "Our folk know Basliv the Demiurge, and the master of all cats, too," answered the captain. "We neither serve them nor care overly much about their whims. But some greater force is at work now. We know this. They send you, but their purpose is not of them. It is of the greater power." And then the broad-shouldered, curly-bearded dwarf clamped his mouth shut and folded his arms. He had said all he would say in response to Gord's question. "I see," Gord replied. Not fully understanding, but accepting this mysticism as something the dwarf chose to believe. "Fare you well, captain, and company all." As he turned away and began to stride northward, the stout demi-human rumbled after him. "The armlet you wear, Gord of Greyhawk, was forged long and long ago by the smiths of Grothheim. It bestows the strength of our folk upon you in certain ways." All right, break. So Grofheim is either going to be some, town or city of the mountain dwarves, or actually a name for perhaps a mountain kingdom, and very worth noting. And I always like it when they're discussing things of the distant past, because we really don't know that much about the past. We don't have much information about the dwarven kingdoms and the mountain dwarves. So right here, we have Grofheim. I'm not quite sure what it is, but again, going with Gygax's liking of Tolkienisms, it sounds to me like an ancient dwarven kingdom. And until I hear something different, I'd probably use that as an ancient dwarven kingdom in my own work. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 72 and the first paragraph. At this, Gord turned back toward the dwarves and bowed slightly in a gesture of thanks and respect. He had never suspected that the armband was anything but a valuable piece of jewelry. Now, he had been told that it was special for a greater reason than the gold it was made of. The dwarven captain nodded to Gord. Behind him, his fellow warriors raised their weapons in a silent salute. The whole incident moved Gord deeply. Enems and Diomer's man, dwarves are very strong against them, the captain shouted out. Then he and his men turned and trudged on corded legs back toward the rugged hills of the Penn Wilds. Whether or not the dwarves had any idea of Gord's abilities, air directing him through the forest proved to be exceptionally useful for the young adventurer. Once alone and concealed within the thick growth of the briar tangle's southern verge, Gord transformed himself from man to panther. He was relieved to find that the armlet changed with him, as did his other possessions. There were dangerous beasts in the forest, monsters too, and occasional outlaw bands. Those that Gord was unable to avoid either avoided him or discovered after a brief encounter that it was better not to attack such a creature. A black leopard the size of a jaguar was an unusual creature, to say the least. Too much of a match for lion, carnivorous ape, or green forest ogre. When he eventually came to the open, cultivated lands beyond the briar tangle, Gord changed to his true form again. The herdsmen and farmers of Ket were a mixed race, although Baklunish blood predominated. Although Gord was dark in complexion, as they were, his dress and speech gave him away as a foreigner. The natives shunned a lone wanderer of this sort. Nevertheless, his passage was swift enough, inns and caravansaries providing for his needs. When he finally arrived in Halupulu, Gord sought and found service in the army of the Marcher Lord. When he demonstrated that he could ride well, Gord was assigned to a troop of mercenary lancers. Tests of his weapon skills showed that the new Orimi recruit had no ability whatsoever with recurve bow, but could at least point a lance correctly. He was appointed a private in the company of lancers, commanded by Malik ibn Urchi. Wearing the brown cloak with the white and orange emblem of the Kedai kingdom, Gord rode over the lands around the capital for hundreds of miles, chasing Baoman tribesmen, raiders from the tribes of hillfolk, or local bandits. He learned a smattering of Kedite and Baklunish speech, and his comrades told him that his accent no longer sounded Eastern. And abruptly one night he deserted the troop, leaving without farewell or regret, and went alone into the teeming streets of Halupulu. All right, break. I'd actually forgotten that. I'm Bard Dillingham. So there's a question here about, I believe, Bard Dillingham. And according to this book, it is the single 3,000 or 4,000 person town inside the Vale of the Mage. So You know, in this case, it's in a big difference from the map. Now, it's somewhere, I would suspect, where they have, like, say, Mossberg on this map, far enough down into the valley itself. And there's also a nearby castle. Yes, this... I like Basiliv so much better than Jason Crimea or Jaren Crimea, as they tagged him in other releases. So here is the Demiurge Basiliv. About Grothheim. I don't think we're going to hear, and I don't even know if Grothheim is anything but a ruin at this point, because... I'm taking it to be an actual mountain dwarven kingdom, and the amulet, the bracer they gave him. I think that there really was no name for him when Gygax was writing this. I don't think. The name Basiliv or Jason or Jaren Crimea had come up yet. It is a little bit, it is, like we said, a little bit confusing when we get all this business. And there has been some very interesting detail. So, like, right here, Ket, it appears that south of the river of La Pala, not River of Pala, where La Pala is on this river, appears that south of this is very wild country. And then it means that the northern area of Ket is this area with herdsmen and farmland, which, must be, very, tamed for them to be able to have that kind of land there. There's, it's also, it's noted that the, in Ket, the mixture, we have the Baclunish, but then we also have, because they're right on, the Bissell is right on their, eastern border right there. And there are a lot of, barn mercenaries from Flaness in Ket. There are also a lot of traders, and it is the main access place to get a Baclunish goods shipped to the east and, Flaness goods shipped to the west. And then you get onto the Velverdiva, there, and you're able to travel, take this stuff right off to the Near Dev and all the cities there and over to Greyhawk. So, Bissell, Ket is a very important the eastern states, and it's right there is the main route of travel, because the other route is up in the wilds by Uz and the tiger and wolf nomads. So they are obviously getting trade. They mentioned in Stoink that they were receiving a lot of trade from, or they're receiving trade from, the Baclunish west. So I'd imagine that might have come down from northern trade route, but this Ket is really the central trade route from the Baclunish to the Flaness. All right, and so we get a little bit here about their organization and everything, and now he's in La Pala or Lupalu, the capital. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 73. Paragraph 2. The city was a mixture of cultures, but it was more of west than east. Lupalu was divided into a fortress compound of great size, the Kasbah, a crowded market district, the Souk, a residential quarter, the Medina, a sector for foreigners known as the Ormistan, and a place of warehouses and the like. Each portion of the city was walled off from the others. This was purposeful, not a case of happenstance, as it was in some eastern towns and cities. He took up residence in the foreign quarter, traveling here and there in Halupala, dressed in native garb, looking, listening, and learning so that he could pose as a Kedite. He managed to do well enough in the few weeks he had to further study the manners and speech of Upalu. As he had been told by both Demiurge and Catlord, some event would occur that would take him from the capital of Ket. What the event was, neither could say for certain, but Baslev had said that Gord's journey would be west and southward, and Rexphilus assured him that, once it was underway, he would recognize the enemy and know instinctively what he must do. More than that, neither could tell him. Gord stayed in Halupalu and waited for fate to move him. He continued to practice his skills, thievery, gymnastics, weapon play, as much as he could, but he did not actually ply any of these arts beyond mere rehearsal. In fact, at times he felt frustrated, for it seemed to him that he was becoming more and more a regular swordsman, and less a thief and burglar. This boded ill for his purse, for the pay of a mercenary, no matter his ability and prowess, was laughable when compared to the return from a single successful mission, such as the ones he had undertaken as Black Cat the Burglar. Then came the night when he was seated in the Dar Peshtwar, watching one incredibly lovely dancer perform, or recalling another dancer another time, and another place long past, much distant. Was the combat there in his flight with Zulman and the pearl to the Penors the sign he was supposed to wait for? Perhaps, perhaps not. It didn't matter now, for there was nothing he could do about those events. What had occurred, and Gord was now committed to action. Although he had seen no enemy as he had been told he would, it seemed to be time for him to move westward. Once he had left Halupalu, the young adventurer felt strongly that he must follow a new strand spun by fate. Those who sought the last portion of the malign artifact would have to travel this way, Gord reflected. It stood to reason, then, that he must ride forth to meet them in some other locale than the city. Whether it came from native intelligence or by the hand of some greater power, this belief was to prove correct. Break. All right, that is the end of chapter 3, page 74 right here. Now, we have Gord. Gord has gone through a little change here. He's not in the service of the Demiurge or the Cat Lord. He's not sworn an oath like he did to Curly Greenleaf, but he has chosen for himself and his strong dislike for the malign evil entities out there, like Obmi, who he's encountered, and chosen for himself to go on this unknown mission with very little to go on and just trusting to fate. So Gord has changed right there. Now, there was a comment before where he said he had been in this Peshtwar, a wine house in Halupalu, and he had seen this beautiful dancing girl being sold off, and a Tuzmiti nomad who she was in love with, and the Tuzmiti nomad was going to steal her away, and the padishah of one of these towns or areas, he bought her, and he sends an assassin and then his guards. And then there's a general melee between the Baklunish Ketite people, Western mercenaries and such, and the Tuzmiti nomad. And other nomads who are of no real liking for the more civilized Baklunish. Now, we were given a lot of information about the Tuzmiti culture, which I hadn't remembered. And it turns out that they actually, there's a river, and they actually have, where they're butted up with Zeif, but that isn't the real borderland. They have, they're only semi-nomadic. They have four different towns, one for each season, this one tribe at least, and there are other tribes. And it starts south of Tet, and it curves out along what is Zeif land all the way into Tuzmit. The borders aren't this big river. There's some semicircle of land west of Ket and through what is looks to be the Zeif territory. So it's really not the Zeif territory. And I found that very interesting. It was very interesting to see some stuff about the Baklunish and about the Tuzmiti I hadn't used before. All right, now, so Gord is still following fate and still hopefully interacting with the champions of evil who are going to look for the third and final artifact of the artifact of evil. All right. We're going to start on in page 75, chapter 4, paragraph 1. Ami stood fidgeting before the fearsome trio. Zuckmoy, demon queen of fungi, was in human form, looking ravishingly lovely, even to the jaundiced eye of the dwarf. Beside her lounged Yggdrasil, likewise seeming to be nothing more than a young and incredibly beautiful female. Between exchanges of girl talk, these two would chatter with Uz. The Cambion was irate at this behavior, but he dared not speak to either female about his anger. In fact, Abmi gloated mentally when the towering Cambion had started to take out his frustrations by snarling at Abmi. Zuckmoy and Yggdrasil had intervened. "Stop that," the great witch had commanded. "Yes, Uz, you know that the dwarf is no longer yours," Zuckmoy had added. "Abmi is mine now, and I will not tolerate meddling for another when it comes to my servants." Finally, unable to stand it any longer, Uz interrupted the two females with a loud demand. "If you're going to waste your time, that is up to you. But I have better things to do. If you ever get down to important matters, you may inform me. Perhaps I will attend and give you the benefit of my wisdom." "Stay, Uz," Yggdrasil said. The tone was conversational, but her look and meaning were unmistakable. She would have no such conduct from her son. Zuckmoy smiled at the glowering Cambion. "Very well, dear Uz. We have had enough of gossip, I think. It is just a matter of letting those who must obey you know exactly where they stand." The demoness said, giving Abmi a casual glance. Uz ground his hunched 100 little fangs in fury at the manner in which his mother treated him. He said nothing, but he held in his heart a growing hatred for the most ancient and powerful of witches. One day soon, Yggdrasil would regret her treatment of him. First, however, he would use her to attain rule of all Earth. "I consent to your wishes, greatest of ladies," Uz said, smiling and nodding. "It is merely that I believe my dear father, wrought his scabrous skin, will be acting with more expeditiousness." "Your apology is accepted, Uz," Yggdrasil said, knowing full well that statement would annoy him. She meant to teach this sprat some manners soon, but not until his usefulness was ended. The witch waved a hand toward the sweating dwarf. "Are you ready for instruction?" "Zuckmoy, did you enjoy being my toad?" the demoness inquired. Inquired, smiling at the dwarf as she did so. All right, break, we have Chris's put up, probably from, I don't
know. Deities and Demigod.
That is the Deities and Demigods. Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Louis rules the evil land of Pohjola with an iron hand. She opposes all of the good heroes of the Kavala and works continuously for their downfall. Yes, and one of the things why we're bringing this up is Gygax names Yggdrasil Louis so that Yggdrasil is then really a combination. You know, she is Yggdrasil, in my game, the mother of witches, and from Blackmoor. But Louis, she's also known in Blackmoor as Louis. Among humans of the more southerly nations, she's known as Yggdrasil. And among the tribesmen, like the Rovers and the Wolf Nomads, I have her as Baba Yaga. Now, Baba Yaga is the Slavic form of Louis. When the Slavs, who later became, you know, ruled by the Viking Rus, they were the original ones who interacted with the Finns, and they took the tales of Louis and they added Baba Yaga to their folklore. She isn't a part of their older Slavic religion, but she is part of the later Christianized period of folklore that the Slavs use. So I like to see, you know, in my own campaign, I just use the different aspects. Louis among Blackmoor, Yggdrasil among men, and Baba Yaga among the eastern tribesmen, and perhaps the Tena see her, and she takes the forms, because one of the things about Yggdrasil and Zuckmoy is they can appear in various forms at will. Right now, their aspect is of incredibly beautiful women. Zuckmoy, of course, turns into a mound of fungi. And Yggdrasil, among witchcraft, there's the mother, and the hag. And so, we have each one of them. Louis would probably have been the mother, whereas Baba Yaga would be the hag. But they have a very decrepit form looked of Louis there. But in the Kavala, she's not supposed to. She's supposed to be the mother of this beautiful young maiden who falls in love with one of the heroes of the Kavala. She's really in the role of the mother there than exactly as the old crone. And Baba Yaga really is more of the old crone, but, there's a lot of shape-changing going on there.
Yeah, I think her daughter gets involved with Vainamoinen.
Yeah, and there's a lot of fun things going on. There's, there's the great hero poet-singer. Now, in Finnish mythology, their magic is like bardic magic. They summon it up usually, but there's a lot of rituals and stuff, but they also do, the heroes tend to be these warlock singers. There's a number of different time periods in the Kavala. And as you notice, Mordenkainen, Vanamoinen, that Kainen business is a normal part of Finnish names. And it always makes me think that Mordenkainen must have some link to Yggdrasil. Or perhaps he's from Blackmoor, I don't know. But it's very interesting what Gygax was fooling around with back then. All right. I am going to roll up things for tonight. I'm going to be jumping over to Jay's show, and they start early over there. So I think if there's not any other commentary or anything, I'm going to wrap it up for tonight, and I'm going to call Craig back in.
Maybe just one thing. I thought it was interesting that gift that Gord got from the mountain dwarves assimilated to his skin, unlike the spear that he had in Artifact of Evil.
I think that's because he got the spear from the evil bugbear serving us. And I think while it was usable by a neutral, it was probably an evil weapon. And I don't think he's maybe able to assimilate the evil weapons into his panther form or cat form. So I think that's why that spear, which it shouldn't have been too powerful, I think, because the bugbear had it. But at the same time, I think it's mainly because it was an evil, probably a characteristically evil weapon created by some evil demon crafter.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that this gift assimilating proves that out.
Yes, yes. And I'm not sure what alignment he would have had the mountain dwarves, but I don't think that they would have been evil.
Right.
All right. I'm going to leave and say goodnight for tonight.
Good night.
Good night.